Good evening. Welcome, everybody. Welcome both to our participants here with us at the Royal Society and also to our online participants. This is a rather unusual, a rather special meeting of the Foundation for Science and Technology, because instead of having an expert panel on a tricky issue, we wanted to celebrate and mark Patrick Vallance's fantastic 5 years as Chief Science Advisor, which came to an end at the end of March. I think there's a round of applause starting.
You should.
Being a group of people interested in science and technology, we weren't just going to stand around and have a drink. We thought we would turn it into a proper discussion. So I'm going to set the ball rolling by asking Patrick some questions myself to start the conversation, and then of course we'll turn to participants here to ask questions. And also, for people online, do use the Q&A function, not the chat function, do use the Q&A function on Zoom, and do start putting in your questions, and do upvote questions that you think are the key ones, and that will help me identify where we should take the conversation. So everybody knows Sir Patrick, who has had a fantastic career both in industry, in GSK, in academia, UCL, and of course 5 years as Government Chief Science Advisor. And let me now, Patrick, set the ball rolling by asking you to reflect on those 5 years as Chief Science Advisor. What were the high points and what were the low points? What are you most proud of, and what was the messiest, nastiest, trickiest issue that you got yourself involved in?
I may be circumspect on that, Bob. If I think about sort of the different domains, during the COVID period, there's no doubt that I think a big highlight was actually the vaccine task force and what we did to get that set up, and the day that we found out the result of the first vaccine with a 90%+ efficacy was absolutely brilliant and a massive high point. Another one that I think personally was exciting was actually trying to ask the question, what could the world do to get vaccine therapeutics and diagnostics out within 100 days of a new organism having been identified? It's a 100-day mission. And that was a great exercise, international exercise to have led. And I particularly enjoyed one particular moment when I was presenting to the G7, and they were all in the hotel in St. Ives, and it was a Zoom call. And I was on Zoom, they were there live, and the other two people on Zoom were Narendra Modi and Melinda Gates. And so it was a slightly weird situation. And the Prime Minister said to me, okay, Patrick, you know, lead us off on this. So I talked to him and he stopped. Oh, no. You're on mute.
I'm sure I'm not on mute. I looked around and somebody came up and whispered and said, no, you haven't got your headphone on. So it was his lack of headphone rather than my mute that was stopping it. Being part of 100 Day Mission was definitely an exciting thing. And I think, you know, the other things I'd pick out would be the climate work and getting a science day at COP26 and being able to really make sure the government was totally behind science in COP26. And amazingly, that was the first time a COP meeting had ever had a science day, mm-hmm. which was quite extraordinary. So that I think was good. And then on the sort of science inside government, the way that the CSA network has developed, I really like the way that evolved. And I'm really pleased that there's now a target to have 50% of the fast stream with a STEM degree. And then the other thing which, you know, has to bed in and become, I think, a standard part of the system is the formation of the National Science and Technology Council chaired by the Prime Minister. The idea that science and technology is a prime ministerial accountability across all departments, I think. So those were some of the things that I think were highlights, and I think I enjoy getting right. I mean, lots of things, of course, get messy, and there's no doubt that there were some pretty horrific days during COVID, and it was very, very difficult in the first few months with not knowing what was going on, lack of data flows from appropriate places, and difficulty in actually trying to work out how the science advice could be incorporated into operational activities and so on. Those were really difficult, and in trying to do that with daily figures of deaths puts a, you know, very, very poignant pressure into the system, and that I think was undoubtedly one of the most difficult times, not just for me but for lots of people, and very pressurized I think on the teams as well in the department.
Do you think we were slow on the uptake? Do you think it should all have we were slow to register the scale of the problem and slow to act?
I mean obviously the inquiry is going to look at all these things. I think if you look at how things happened in January, including getting vaccines started, getting research funding going for the viral work, the epidemiology, the social sciences, all of that started in January. And I don't think that's slow. I mean, I think at that point, if you look around the world, people weren't waking up to what this would be. Now, you know, then there's all sorts of questions about how quickly you can implement some of the things and operationally how things work. But I think those are questions that will come up during the inquiry, and it's the appropriate place to do it.
And what was it like working with Dominic Cummings?
Well, Dominic Cummings was a huge supporter of science and technology.
Yep,
and, you know, I think that was important, actually. Mm-hmm. He did create access to Number 10. And he was definitely somebody who helped push the formation of things like the National Science and Technology Council. He was important to raise the profile of science and technology in government. And then there's all the other bits that you'll know about, David.
But I agree with you on the science, and he always was and remains very interested in all that. Do you think that perhaps partly because of a result of how closely you were working with the Prime Minister and senior ministers during COVID, that the chief science advisor job, which was originally science for policy, also became policy for science? And is that a distinction that you think matters? The classic view would be they're rather different roles. Do you think they should be disentangled? Or do you think that it's rather over fastidious to try to distinguish between them?
Well, they are different. And I will say, at its heart, I think science for policy is the role of, which is the unique thing which chief scientific advisors do. Because there's also lots of people talk about policy for science. Yeah. And my view is, I cannot think of a single area of government policy where science, engineering, and technology wouldn't make a difference. Mm-hmm. And it's that where the science of policy becomes so important. How do you embed that so that it's a routine part of how departments work? It's not something over there that you go and ask for when you think you've got a scientific problem. It's about embedding that in every single thing. I mean, you think about transport, it's absolutely science and engineering. You think about our housing stock, design of cities, of course our healthcare, our communications approach, our defence, resilience, our approach actually to the economy. I mean, every single aspect has science and engineering, and therefore you need advice of science and engineering into policy. That's not policy for science. So I think there is a very clear distinction, which is the chief scientific advisor's role. It's also inevitable that you get pulled into policy for science, and you have to comment on it, because in a sense, what you're doing is giving science advice for policy for science in that situation, because you're giving expert advice into it. But I don't think it's the role of the government chief scientific advisor to design policy for science. I think it's to give advice into that. The policy design is for the policy officials and ministers.
And so do you think, there's going to be a separate chief technology advisor, do you see any structural changes or just appointments and roles that bring that disentangle those more?
Well, I think the National Technology Advisor role is very much about being linked to industry and pushing advice on technologies that government would want to pursue and what the strategies and policies are that go along with it. So it is more over on the policy side in terms of what levers you could pull to make sure that if we want to, as a nation, really make sure we've got the right capabilities in those things, that we get all the levers pulled across government. So I think there is a bit more of that there. And it's also the case, as I've said, that I don't think that the GCSA or any other CSA can avoid policy for science, but you're giving advice, you're not designing it.
Right. When you looking at the changes in policy over the past few years, I mean, I think one significant change has been that in the old days, science and technology was not seen as relevant for solving policy problems in the time scales that ministers and civil service advisors cared about. And now, and it is a refreshing change, and you played a key part in it, but Dominic Cummings also played a part in it. There's a recognition that science and technology are relevant for solving policy issues in the relevant time. I can remember writing to the minister responsible for disability benefits, trying to get her to use a bit of her budget on innovation in technologies for disabled people. And I could sense I was getting nowhere. But my view is that 10 years on, that kind of willingness to see science and technology as part of the policy answer has become more significant. Do you think that's now, how much has that depended on certain personalities, or do you think that is now a wider cultural change?
I think it is a wider cultural change, and I think there is definitely pull for that. So there wasn't a pull for it. It was a very much a push job, you know, try and insert yourself and get those comments made. I think there is a pull. It's not even across government, but there's no doubt that amongst any meeting of permanent secretaries, that would be a sort of positive discussion where people would want to engage and pull through. And I think ministers do as well. But of course, there's a dearth of people who can give that. And to your point about time, one of the things that's important for science advice is timeliness. You know, it's no good saying, actually, if you just give me another 5 years, we can come up with your answer for you. So I do think that this is part of why enabling the civil service to be very well equipped with scientists and engineers is an important part of this, in my opinion.
Is another change the rise of the security angle? I mean, there's always been, of course, a significant defense and security spend on R&D and science and tech, but the security perspective on science and technology has now seems to me to have become pervasive, that links between the security agenda and the civil and commercial agenda seem to be a lot stronger, partly the influence of the American understanding that actually technological advance is a key competitiveness, economic and security feature of the advantage of the West, which needs to be protected. But give us your reflections on how closely you felt able to link the classic civil and commercial perspective, coming from many scientists who don't necessarily have any security clearance even to be in the room, and equally a different group of people, historically very different, sitting in the MOD and the security agencies. Have links got stronger, and is that a good thing if they have?
I think links are much stronger, and one only has to look at the pronouncements of some of the heads of the agencies. Jeremy Fleming has been very clear about what he sees as the role of technology and science in national security, so the other agency heads. And also, if you look around the world, countries, many, many countries are becoming enabled in science and technology that weren't. So it was very much a dominance of US, Europe for a long time. China, of course, is extremely good at some of this now, and many smaller countries are able to do it as well. So I think this is now a geopolitical and a security issue. And that was reflected in the Integrated Review. And the Integrated Review, which set out to describe the position of the UK in the world and the foreign policy associated with that, I think was extraordinary in that it had a chapter on science and technology, and it had science and technology running through every single chapter. And I just don't think that would have been the case in the past. So that did change the outlook, and it changed the thinking. And of course, one of the things that I think was important in that was the recognition that part of your resilience is your ability to have companies that are doing the type of science and technology that you need to make products that are relevant. So that's true for resilience against, you know, natural disasters like pandemics and so on, but also for security. And so that link between economic and security matters, I think, is important.
And tell us, just sticking with that for a bit long, because you and certainly. And were you involved in the drafting of the relevant chapters of the Integrated yes. Review and the Refresh as well?
Yes.
And so there was a proper chief science advisor input. I mean, there is, part of that has been exercises to identify key technologies that need support. 10 years ago, drawing on science and technological advice, we did the 8 great technologies. More recently, Bayes did the 7 technology families. That wasn't too far back. Now we've got these 5 technology priorities, 4 of which are in a kind of security dry digital computational family, and we have engineering biology, which is the application in some ways of classic digital engineering techniques to biological sciences. Do you think, was there why, as you've ended on the 5, to what extent was that just a path-dependent process, that there had been some interest in a particular technology at one point, as a result of which you've got a group of Whitehall experts who then campaigned very vigorously for their technology? And to what extent was there a rational review, including of the 7 that Bayes had identified only 18 months earlier, that had led to this new group appearing?
Well, maybe I'll take one step back. So in the Integrated Review, the concept of being clear as a nation as to where we wanted to play in areas was defined under what was called own collaborate access. So in other words, you can't be, we can't be, no nation can be probably absolutely all over every single technology.
Yep.
And yet you want to make sure that you've got enough ability to do them if you need to do them. And so the own position would be end-to-end, the UK is able to do it in some form. Collaborate would be, well, we're good at bits of it and we want to do bits of it, but we know we're going to have to collaborate with like-minded allies or whoever in order to make ourselves whole in that. And access would be, well, actually, we don't think we've got a real position here of any significance, but we know we might need something, so how are we going to access it if we do, which might be an investment or might be a collaborative, or might be some sort of partnership. So that, I think, was the framework, which then said, well, when you get, of course, when you start that, everyone says, well, my technology is owned, and it's end to end. That's where everyone starts. Yep. So the question was, how do you start to disentangle that? And in Go Science, there's now a group that's there to provide independent assessment of all of these technologies using a standardized framework. That provides an input, and then ultimately ministers are going to have to make decisions about where they want to do things. But I think unless we go down that sort of route, we end up being sort of half good at lots of things, and we're going to have to make some choices to where. And this is not about the basic science, which of course is inevitably and properly very broad. It's about where we want to grow our private sector success as well.
But isn't own collaborate access a good example of fundamentally a security and requirement way of thinking? And doesn't it sometimes generate different results than if you had a comparative advantage business opportunity way of thinking? And isn't the rise of that methodology evidence of a shift in the balance of policy influence away from people who said, we've got a bunch of scientists and technologists who are really good at this, and it's there's a big market coming up, there's a big global market opportunity, we're not thinking about whether we need to own it or access it, we just want to make some money out of it, and we think there's a chance we could here. That is a a slightly different framework.
I'm not sure it is. I'm not sure it is because, as you just described it, that's exactly when you'd say, well, actually, we want to have a slice of the cake here, and therefore we need to support it. And so you would want to have a basis. And yes, you can use own collaborate access as a sort of security based approach, but I don't think it is that. I mean, frankly, it's an economically based approach as far as I see it, which is, where do you think you want to stimulate success? And of course, you've got to be flexible because stuff happens. So it shouldn't, in my view, be applied to any discovery science. I mean, we should be broad. We should do whatever we need to do. And because we live in an open democracy, stuff will happen that you don't plan, and then you need to be responsive to it and support it. But what we haven't been good at is supporting our discovery base through to scaled companies. And that's really what this is trying to do, is say, if you want to scale companies and have the ability to therefore be really good at that, that needs intervention sometimes. It needs things like supply chain considerations as well. If you go back again to the pandemic, at the beginning of the pandemic, if you ask the question, where was the vaccine industry in the UK? It had sort of disappeared. And it hadn't disappeared because somebody said, you know what, we don't need this anymore. It was benign neglect. And a similar thing happened to some extent around 5G. You know, what did we need to do? So I think there are areas where it's important to at least be aware what it is you think you're going to need, and make sure that if that is what you want, you take the steps to try and encourage it, support it in a private sector environment. I mean, it has to be led by that being successful, otherwise the whole thing doesn't work.
It was a 5G strategy, of course. It happened to involve Huawei, which proves subsequently...
No, but that's precisely...
It was a Vodafone Huawei.
That's precisely the point, yeah. Because under the model, you would have had to said, we actually want to do this through collaboration with only one partner who is in China as an active decision, which I don't think was what anyone meant.
No. Do you think that UKRI, how is UKRI working? It's most of UKRI's life has been during your time as chief science advisor. A lot of the issues you've been talking about, you could argue, fall directly into the lap and the responsibility of UKRI. Has it got the right role? How is it discharging its responsibilities? Give us its 6-year on assessment.
Well, I think UKRI was set up to do a number of things, in my view. One was to ensure that the interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary nature of research was properly accounted for. I mean, things don't sit into buckets and they need to work across research councils. The second was to try to make sure that aspect of research funding had a louder voice inside government. And the third was to try and make sure that the links to early stage industrial use would be better. And I think, you know, it's made progress on those areas, but there's a lot still that needs to be done. And that's been recognized by a number of reports that have been written. Ottolien, of course, knows that there are things that need to change, and it's easier to do all of that when you've got an increasing funding baseline, not when you're trying to squeeze everything into the same pot. So I think fundamentally there's a system there that can work. We do need to, you know, lots of people have written stuff on this, as a nation, make sure that we don't turn this into a massive bureaucracy, because that does not help anybody.
We've talked a lot about sort of policy and influence and priorities. You have briefly referred to the sort of the discovery science. Is the Haldane principle still as relevant as ever? Do you think the Haldane principle is rightly defined? Have you had moments when you've thought, why the bloody hell does this stop us really getting involved in setting priorities?
Well, I think it's quite interesting because, of course, very few people take the trouble to go back and read what Haldane actually said. And one of the things that he did say, which I think was a very important part of setting up this, he described specific and general research. And specific research was what was dominant at the time, which was research that a department needed, that it would simply say, do this research. And his point was there needs to be general research, which is things that academics and others want to pursue, which creates the environment from all the other things to happen. And so that's important and remains important. And my strong view on this is that in any country that wants to be a science and technology based country, you've got to fund that basic curiosity driven, peer reviewed quality research, and you've got to fund it to a significant degree because everything else follows from that. And the same, by the way, is true in companies. It's quite interesting that if you look at big companies, the easiest part of any budget to cut is the research budget, because it doesn't actually make a difference for 5 years, but then it makes one hell of a difference and you're stuffed. And I think the same is true for nations. Look after that basic fundamental curiosity driven science. And yes, I believe that that other part of the Haldane principle, which is the choices as to what's funded, should be done by the experts who know about it, not by politicians.
And both in the Haldane model and also in subsequent attempts at reform, like the Rothschild exercise, one doctrine was that the science department or the research councils or whatever were funding the discovery research, if you like. And the people who would best have an understanding of how you wish to apply research were the departments, and departments of state would be custodians of applied R&D budgets. And you could argue over time, and Rothschild being the most famous example of that doctrine, and you could argue over time that departments started behaving the way those short-sighted companies did in your examples. The departments cut their R&D budget, so the science budget increasingly picks up the applied R&D responsibility as well. Do you think departments in Whitehall are currently good custodians of R&D in their areas? Did you have conversations, friendly or perhaps not always so friendly, with individual departments about what was happening to their R&D budgets?
Well, in 2019, we published a science capability review, and one of the things that we looked at was the funding of R&D in departments. And in nearly all departments, that had gone down quite considerably over a decade. And so exactly what you said had happened. And some departments were spending a fraction of 1% on R&D. So if you're a company and you spend a fraction of 1% on R&D, you've declared yourself to be no growth commodity company. And that can't possibly be what departments mean to be. And in fact, when I said that at a meeting of permanent secretaries, there was a lot of sort of reaction to, no, we don't mean to be that. So I think that did happen. It was reduced. And so that has been reversed to some extent over subsequent spending rounds. And the R&D budgets are increasing again in some departments. And the notion that this is a key part of what a department needs to care about is there in principle. And the chief scientific advisors in departments, we said that the other thing we said, and I don't think this is quite there yet, was that you shouldn't be able to cut that budget without the agreement of the chief scientific advisor as well as the chief financial officer in the department. So I think looking after that research bit of the department, R&D bit of the department, is very, very important.
And is the Treasury an ally on all this? How are you getting on with
the
Treasury?
The Science Capability Review is written with Treasury for that very reason. And so that bound them in to some extent to what we were doing there. And certainly I'll call out by name Phil Duffy, who's been absolutely superb in Treasury for looking after science and technology. But and you'll be aware of this, David, you know, push comes to shove, all sorts of other things can take priority. And I think that's why insisting that if we mean as a country to be a country based on the opportunities of science and technology, this needs to be an all of government concern, a prime ministerial concern, and something that Treasury backs.
And tell us a bit of how the National Council functions, how it's agenda is decided. What are the big kind of issues that it has covered already and that you might like to see it covering in the future?
Well, the way the National Science and Technology Council was set up or the principle was that it ought to be as indispensable as the National Security Council, because for any prime minister, it would be sort of inconceivable to come in and say, I don't want a National Security Council. It ought to be inconceivable to say that about the NSTC. That was the idea. And then, of course, the prime minister needs to determine which secretaries of state or ministers need to be there. And the agenda is driven in part by a series of government policy priorities of areas that people want to see grow, and in part from the input from UKRI and others as to where they think there are big opportunities.
And you think that's, and what kind of issues might it focus on in the future if you were looking ahead now, where it looked at some individual key technologies, and that's why one argument is there's a bit of path dependency in how we've ended up with the five, in that they tended to be the ones that were early picks, and the gossip tended to go around Whitehall, certainly in the days of Boris, that any discussion of any particular science and technology is going to end up concluding the council you should have a big spend on it, so you have to get in early before all the budget's spent. How is it going to be looking at one particular area of science and take off from another? Is it going to look more horizontally? How do you think?
Well, if you look at the 10-point framework that was published, it covered skills and education, procurement, which, by the way, I think is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. How do you government procurement pull things through? One of the 10 was technologies. So, I mean, you're right that there is a sort of an attraction to technologies, big shiny objects thing. But actually, the whole point was there are 10 areas that are inevitably cross-cutting. So if you take skills and education, that isn't just Department for Education. It involves the Home Office. It involves DWP. It involves other departments that need to be thinking about that. And so those 10 things, I think, are what NSTC needs to work its way through and say, are we happy we've got a very clear, deliverable plan against those? And you may or may not know, but at the outset of trying to get the NSTC set up, we asked the question, how many strategies are there for science and technology across government? And the answer was there were 63. Now, you know, that's not a strategy. And so clean that up, get to the 10 areas that must be covered, and go through them systematically to make sure there's a delivery plan against them to do things. That was the idea.
And
that's what I'd like to see. Yeah. I mean, it's not my job.
And the framework document that came out just recently, earlier this year, is a kind of account of that, a distillation of that. And you basically are saying that you regard as an agenda, working through that as an agenda for the future. It's interesting seeing what's coming in online, and of course we'll come to the audience as well, but just it's helping indicate further areas to talk to. And just to talk about, one issue is, you mentioned just in your list of 10, education and skills, and there have been some questions, including from Francis Cairncross online, just about what kind of university courses you would like to see. When you say 50% STEM, of course, there are STEM courses that are very narrowly and particularly focused on a discipline. Can you envisage people being able at university to do courses that combine STEM and also some economics or even, dare one say it, political science, linking their STEM interest to the world in which they'd have to function? I mean, have you sat in so many discussions about this, has it left you with a view about the right direction in which our education and skills system should go?
Well, I talked about this right at the beginning of my 5-year tenure, and as always, somebody at the back of the room put a hand up and said, there's a course called PPE, why isn't there a course called PPS? Mm-hmm. Politics, philosophy and science. And actually, I asked this numbers of vice chancellors that question since, is that something that would be worth thinking about? So I think, look, there's no doubt that we need people who are deeply specialist in certain areas and have got real focus on things. But I think there are many more courses that could actually combine areas. And if you look at innovation and entrepreneurs, the idea it's all STEM people that do that is nonsense. Mm-hmm. I mean, it requires arts, humanities, social sciences, and others involved in it. So I think what's important, and the reason the 50% STEM target for the civil service is important, is because in the science capability review, we found out that the current situation is 10%. Well, it's crazy in a world that's completely becoming dominated by science and technology advances, that you've got 10% of your graduate scheme with a STEM degree. So the 50% is not a magic number. It's just to try and rebalance to something which seems a bit more sensible, but it should not be 90% STEM, right, for sure.
But isn't part of the answer to your question, your challenge to the vice chancellors, it's a kind of producer capture that the physics lecturers at university want to teach people who already know a lot of physics, and they don't want particularly to teach people who haven't done a physics A-level, and the people teaching economics the same. So specialization, the bane of the English system, is partly driven by the academic community's desire at university to be recruiting and teaching people who already know quite a bit about their subject. And breadth is hard to achieve in that system. Sitting here in the Royal Society, successive presidents of the Royal Society, I know almost every former education minister has come to the conclusion that early specialization and the 3 A-level model is the bane of English education. Could you envisage a world in which we didn't repeat Labour's mistake in 2005 of dumping the thing, but said, we love A-level so much, why don't people do 5 or 6 A levels? Why, and probably a maths A level is one of them, and adjust A levels a bit so that each A level doesn't require quite so much, and it's reasonable to expect someone to have continued doing some maths and to have done some history and to have done a science. You know, is that a vision?
You're on a roll here, David. I can see that.
well, the more important question is whether you're on a roll, well, whether you think that this is an agenda you would back.
Yeah, I think
become a free agent.
The Royal Society has actually argued for this.
Yeah, it has. Absolutely.
And actually, the Council for Science and Technology has argued for this. And I co-chaired the Council for Science and Technology. So I think a broader education is something that's important. I think what we shouldn't lose, though, and this is, I think, the real difficulty in some of this, is some of our sort of specialism actually has led to some really great people who've done extraordinary things. And so what we absolutely need to watch out about is just sort of superficial generality, and that I think is the challenge. But we are, in my view, too far over on specialism too early.
Yeah, and of course the Americans do it by, it's really the masters where you start getting dug in, and they do have this extraordinary range earlier. Looking at the questions coming in, and I will come to the audience here in a moment. We haven't touched on Europe. Pick some questions about Horizon Europe, whether it's the value of associating with it versus the view that really post-Brexit, associating with Horizon Europe now is a much inferior deal to what we had. Maybe we could do better on our own. Where are you on all that very live issue at the moment?
Horizon.
You're pro it.
Yeah, completely. I mean, it's a no-brainer that we should do Horizon, in my view. It is, if you think about how long it took for Horizon to get set up and working properly, these things aren't made overnight, and they take a time to get operating, to get the collaborations working. And at a time when you've got, if you just took a security angle for this, if you took the rise of China as a real science and technology power, you take the changing views in terms of sometimes the way other countries want to collaborate, the idea that Europe would disable itself by us not being us and us disable ourselves by not being part of that, I think is wrong. And I think it's a very good scheme that also provides two things which are quite difficult to get at in other ways. One is it's a different set of review processes and reviewers who come up with different answers to the ones that we do domestically. Yep. And that's always the case. And the second is scale.
Yep.
There's a scale point that we cannot replicate on our own. So I think Horizon is important for us. I think the EU has made it clear. I mean, I think it's terrible that it got caught up in the Northern Ireland Protocol. That's incredibly bad that it got pulled into sort of political football as part of that. But the EU's now made it clear that they're open for us to join, and the government has previously committed to be part of it. And I understand there's got to be a negotiation around the new terms and so on, but I hope that that's dealt with as quickly as possible, and the sooner we join, the better. And plan B is plan B.
Thanks very much for that very clear answer.